Hi, everyone. This is Kate Jetmore from the Listen Podcast. We're currently on hiatus, making some changes in our team and our format before we return this fall. But some things just can't wait. Just as the second wave of coronavirus seems to be getting underway here in Spain, where I live, an alarming increase in positive cases is also taking place where I grew up, in Indiana. Today, I'll be sitting down with an expert in an effort to get the facts out and to let people know in a clear and concise manner how we can all pitch in and work together to flatten the curve. My guest today is Dr. David Jetmore, a retired ENT and otolaryngologist. Dr. Jetmore practiced medicine in Richmond, Indiana, and the surrounding area for nearly 40 years. He currently serves as the Wayne County Health Officer. He also happens to be my dad. Welcome, Dr. Jetmore. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, good morning, Kate. I guess it's evening in Spain, but it's, it's evening, or it's afternoon here in Indiana. It's just after noon.
Well, it's good to see you over the miles and over the hours.
Yeah, it's good to see you too.
Let's start with your position as Wayne County Health Officer. How did you come to be in that position?
Well, the health officer is a position appointed by the Board of Health, and that position is one that lasts for about 4 years. Last summer, I was approached by the president of the Wayne County Board of Health to become the new health officer. And I said, sure, I would be happy to perform this function. And then the greatest pandemic of the 21st century unfolded that January. And so here I am.
Yeah, so I guess you didn't know what you were signing up for, did you?
No, I had no idea that this circumstance would fall upon me.
Well, what does it look like? I mean, I'm guessing that you're engaging in conversations and meetings and decisions every day. Is it every day that you're involved with this, or like every week?
Well, there is an everyday involvement. Some of the things are kind of formalized. Every Tuesday and Thursday, I have a Zoom meeting with county health officers from the surrounding counties and with the representatives of Reed Hospital. We go over the statistics, how many new infections have been reported, how many deaths in our county and the surrounding counties.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Today's Saturday. We're recording on Saturday the 25th. And we plan to share this interview in the next couple of days. So there will be changes in the numbers between the time that we record and we post this interview, but hopefully not too much time will go by. What is it that you're seeing in the numbers that is, give us some facts about this uptick that you're seeing in Wayne County?
Well, after the basically shelter-in-place order by the governor, we found our numbers falling to the point that we would see two or three cases a day. In a week, we might see 10 cases. Then the governor opened up the state, and we began to see an uptick, and then it began to climb a great deal. The week before last, we had 35 cases. Last week we had 71. I wouldn't be surprised if next week we saw 140 if people are not compliant, if people continue to gather and not mask.
So you're seeing, the trend that you're seeing is basically a doubling of cases every week, which would be exponential growth. You mentioned the word masks. I know in the last week, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb issued a mask mandate. Can you tell us what exactly that will entail? I mean, what do people need to do to comply with this order?
Well, the mandate asks the citizens of Wayne County and the state of Indiana to wear a mask and socially distance whenever we're in a public or commercial building, and to socially distance when we're outside, at least 6 feet apart. When the governor opened up the state, people, I think they were weary of not having their lives, their normal lives, so they began to congregate, and probably 20 or 30% of people, maybe less, wore masks, and naturally the cases began to climb. We saw clusters of cases in bars, one cluster of people getting together to play basketball, another cluster from a church group. And so I think it was the realization that we were climbing like this that made the governor want to stop this alarming rise in cases.
So the mask mandate is basically for indoor public spaces, is that right?
That's right. And, you know, the exceptions are children under age of 8, and obviously you can't wear a mask when you're eating or drinking. So right. Those would be the exceptions.
Okay. I think there's some confusion about why the order is coming now. You know, we've been aware that this crisis is a reality. I mean, we all sort of saw what was coming from China maybe in January, something like that. But it's been, you know, in our communities since March. So why weren't people being asked to wear masks back then? Can you clarify why they've become so important now?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was important back then. But as you know, science is kind of the evolution of knowledge. We go with our best hypothesis on what is happening, and then we see the reality and we modify our hypothesis. In the beginning, the World Health Organization, the CDC, local health boards felt that masking wasn't that important. And there were two reasons for this. One, people felt like the particles that came from talking or breathing outward were not going that far. They were just harmlessly falling to the ground. And the other thing was the concern if we told people they needed to wear masks, there was such a shortage of PPE, personal protective equipment, that it was worried that first-line health workers would not be able to find masks to protect themselves. And so this wasn't emphasized. It became very apparent that after we watched the spread of this disease, that these virus particles were coming out in our breath and even farther if we talked or sang, and that masks would trap these particles of moisture on which the viruses were riding. I think a lot of people quibbled about, you know, these virus particles are very small and they could get through the mask, but actually it's not the virus particle itself, but the virus riding on droplets of moisture.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that what the governor has mandated is that people wear masks inside, and that outside it's only obligatory if you can't maintain that social distance of 6 feet. What about, I'm just curious, should you also be social distancing if you're wearing the mask? I mean, can you feel safe to be close to someone if you're wearing the mask, or should you still leave that 6 foot distance if you can?
No, you should still have that 6 foot apart and wear the mask. If you're outside, there's much less concern because of the huge volume of air which dissipates the virus. You're not going to get ill if one virus particle inhales you and you inhale one virus particle. You become ill when you get a certain load of virus particles. Then you become infected.
So that's why we see such alarming numbers among healthcare workers, right? Because they are, you know, in the ER, in the ICU. Then they're in the presence of people who have the virus, so their risk is higher because of the viral load. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. beyond the question of masks, what else can Hoosiers be doing to collaborate with efforts to stop the spread of COVID-19? We all want to get back to normal. So what can we all do to, you know, to make it, to bring things back to a safer state?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the things, and this is hard to realize, if everyone on Earth were able to socially isolate, in other words, we're in a room with enough food for 2 weeks and a bathroom and a television to keep us from going crazy, the virus would be over. I mean, it would end in 2 weeks. I mean, that's hard to believe, but that is in fact true. So we can't do that, obviously, because the economy would collapse. People would have no jobs, no money for food. They wouldn't be able to pay their rent, their electric bill. So we need to try to carry on our normal lives with the minimum parameters of distancing ourselves 6 feet from one another and wearing a mask and keeping our hands clean.
Okay. So, yeah, I've definitely heard hand washing. So is that, you know, you walk into your house, you wash your hands. You're getting ready to go out of your house, you wash your hands. You walk into work, you wash your hands. Is that what's being recommended?
That's exactly right. And the main reason for that is if you pick up if you touch a commonly touched surface by other people, you can pick up viruses. And everybody touches their face. So you rub your eyes. The tear duct of your nose conducts the virus inside your nose, and you become infected.
Okay. And would you say that, I mean, it's funny to hear you say, well, if we all had our own little cabin with a 2-week supply of food and the internet, we could beat the virus. And obviously that's not tenable for a variety of reasons. But it is worth tucking that idea away and kind of leaning into it as much as we can. That is to say, if you can work from home, work from home. If you're having a family birthday party, either put it off till next year or have it outside. You know, it sounds like gatherings outside as much as possible would be good because, as you said, there's, you know, a better air current. So as much as you can kind of lean into that idea of how can I keep going with my normal life, but keeping myself as physically distanced as possible?
That's exactly right. I think if people carry that idea in their mind, we can slow down and hopefully stop the transfer of this virus.
You know, one aspect of this situation that is really confusing is that in many cases you can be sick with COVID and have no symptoms at all. You don't feel ill, you're not under the weather. There's no reason to think that you're sick, but you are. And in fact, you and I might be sick right now and not even know it. Is there any way to be sure that you don't have the virus, or should we all be carrying on as if we had the virus?
Well, you make a good point. 45% of people have the virus and they're actively spreading the virus, but they're asymptomatic. In other words, they have no symptoms. They're not even aware they're sick. So I think we have to assume that everybody we see has the virus. If you want to know for sure if you have coronavirus, you would have to have a nasal swab and they would look through that specimen to actually see if the COVID virus is present. And then you would know that you had COVID. But even that's a snapshot in time. If you go in to have a test and it's negative, it might be positive the next day.
Right. Well, this leads me to my next question, which has to do with schools. Because, you know, I know in Indiana, the school year is due to begin. I mean, depending on the school district, it's due to begin very soon. And, you know, given the volatility of this virus that, you know, you might have it and not know it, or you might have a test that proves you don't have it, but then the next day you get it and you don't know it. What can you tell us about schools? What can we all do to keep our children safe?
Well, this is a this is the $64,000 question, because, you know, school makes up an important part of the social fabric of our entire culture. Is there a danger in sending children to school? Obviously there is. Is there a danger in keeping a child home from school? Obviously there is. What are the benefits that the school provides? Well, obviously learning, but also many poor families depend on the school for school lunches. Many families depend on the school to care for their children while they're working. Mm-hmm. So it's a tremendous hardship not to have school. We thought that these children, and this is true, are the least at risk for having serious problems with COVID. Certainly the risk of death are minimal. In fact, the risk of death from COVID is less from the risk of death from the ordinary flu. The danger is the children can spread the virus to people who are more susceptible. Children under 10 actually spread virus less than an adult would. Children over 10 spread the virus as much as an adult would.
That's quite a large percentage of school-age children from 10 to 18.
Sure it is. And so the biggest danger is to the teachers, mm-hmm. the school custodian, the school bus driver, the school nurse, obviously. So it's to the adults.
So how is Wayne County handling this? What has the health department recommended, and have any decisions been made about how and when the school year will begin?
Well, this has fallen on the school itself. They've come up with a plan, and the health department and the health officer, we've been a resource for them, but they've taken the full responsibility for doing this. And we will be starting school at the normal time that we would start. We've given the children the option of having e-learning, in other words, learning from home. Now, this is very difficult if you're a seven-year-old child. It's easily accomplished if you're a college student or a high school student to sit in front of a computer for 6 to 8 hours. A seven-year-old is going to have an adult there with him. And even then, it's very problematic that child is going to get the education that he needs and deserves. As far as trying to keep the children safe in school, they're separating the children, their desk at school. They're going to send children to school, on some children on Monday and Wednesday, the other half on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then alternate Fridays. The rest of the time they will have e-learning. I think this is a good way to compromise and try to have our cake and eat it. I think people all over the United States and probably the world have had to wrestle with this idea of keeping these children safe and yet educating mm-hmm. them.
What about elderly parents, grandparents? What do you have any recommendations for what we can do to keep them safe and healthy?
Yes, and once again, that's another dilemma, Kate, because what do older people need? They need visits from other people. They need to talk to people. They need hugs. They need personal contact. What don't they need? They don't need any of those things in terms of the COVID virus. I haven't seen my elderly 96-year-old mother, who I dearly love, in 6 months. Mm-hmm. She lives at home and is only visited by two of my sisters, both of whom are nurses and are careful to socially distance themselves from their mother. I talk to my mother all the time on the phone, but I don't feel it's safe for me to visit mm-hmm. her. Mm-hmm. So that's a dilemma.
So would you say, I mean, it sounds like you're making the decision to keep her safe by not being in her physical presence and keeping that number to a minimum, the people who are in her physical presence, but finding other ways to be in touch with her, like phone calls.
Yes, we can phone call, or if I drove up there, which is about a 2.5 hour drive, I could sit. I'd feel comfortable sitting outside with her and socially distancing myself from her. The governor recently said that the people of the state of Indiana could have indoor visitation in nursing homes, and I did not feel comfortable with this. I have to follow the mandates of the governor, except I am allowed to make them more strict, and I have basically said that people have to continue to visit nursing home patients outside, especially since this is the most vulnerable part of our population, and because many of the people coming to visit them are elderly.
Yeah.
So as long as we have this, it's summertime and we can visit in early morning or late evening before the heat of the day, I just feel it's much safer to continue to have outside visitation. Mm-hmm. So I've continued that part of Governor Holcomb's earlier mandate.
Let's talk for a second about the long-range effects we've seen from COVID. As you said, many people are carriers who don't even know they're sick. Other people get symptoms that are quite mild. Some people suffer organ failure in multiple organs. They have to be put on a ventilator, and obviously many, many people all over the world have died. Why is this? Is there any way to know who is at the greatest risk or how the virus would affect each of us if we were to get it?
Well, this question really makes me want to make two comments about COVID. The first is that many people thought, and including myself and others, that this would be like the ordinary flu. You might get it and get very sick, but once you recovered, you would be as healthy as you were before. And we've come to find that COVID differs from the ordinary flu, not only in its, you know, level of mortality, but also once you've recovered, because many of these people have been left with a permanent loss of smell, with permanent damage to their lungs, with permanent damage to their heart, and we may find other changes that have been left by the COVID as time goes on. The other thought that this stirs in my mind is the fact that we are finding, as we go along and try to answer this question, why are some people not having any symptoms and other people have a range of symptoms all the way up to mortality, is there must be genetic differences in people that make some people more vulnerable to the virus than others. I'll give you an example. We found that people who have Neanderthal DNA in their body, and let me explain this just briefly. 60,000 years ago, our forebears migrated north out of Africa to Europe, and when they arrived, they encountered Neanderthals. They interbred with these fellow primates. In fact, 4% of our DNA, of those of us of European descent, have Neanderthal DNA. The people in the world that have the most Neanderthal DNA are people from Bangladesh. They have three times the mortality of other people who do not have the same amount of Neanderthal DNA. I think as time progresses, we're going to find other changes, other differences in our genetics that make some of us more susceptible to coronavirus than others.
Mm-hmm. What about those who are lucky enough to survive the virus? I mean, maybe they, whether they, you know, have it and don't feel well for a few days, or whether they have, you know, they're hooked up to a respirator and then manage to survive. Will those people recover entirely, or will they suffer long-term effects the rest of their life?
I think the people who are severely affected by COVID, and I'm talking about people that have been on a ventilator and they eventually recover their pulmonary function or their lung function, those people, many of those people will have lifelong effects from COVID. The people who with mild symptoms and are those who are asymptomatic will probably not have any long-term effects.
I know it's risky to make predictions, but what do you see in Indiana's future? Maybe you could talk about what things will look like if people comply with the mask order, wash their hands frequently, respect social distancing, and what the future will look like if people don't do those things.
Well, as you have surmised, what happens in the future is entirely in the hands of the people. We used to say in the theater that every audience gets the performance they deserve. And I think in this instance, every group of people gets the pandemic they deserve. If people take this seriously, wear masks and socially distance and practice good hand hygiene, the numbers will quickly drop. If people say, I don't care about this, wearing a mask is robbing me of my personal liberty, I think all this is a hoax, then the virus will endure. The virus obeys the laws of viruses, the laws of nature. It doesn't care about politics or whether or not you're tired of wearing a mask. It is a virus and it's going to infect everyone it possibly can. So the mistress I serve are the people of Wayne County, and I'm hopeful that the people of Wayne County will put on their masks, socially distance, wash their hands, and we can keep this pandemic under control. My fear is that people are weary of social isolation, weary of wearing masks, and I think we will see, we will continue to see many outbreaks, and they'll probably emanate from churches, bars, and possibly, and my God, I hope not, possibly from nursing homes. So I think we're in for the long haul. I don't think that we're going to defeat this disease and get back to the life as it was before until we've developed a virus that will make 70% of us, which most epidemiologists consider herd immunity, immune to the disease.
Yeah, it sounds like it's up to us, it's in our hands to comply in such a way that will float us through these outbreaks until there is a vaccine.
That's exactly right.
Dr. Jetmore, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. It's been really helpful hearing the facts laid out in such a clear and understandable way. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Kate. You're very kind, and thank you for having me.
The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain. Check out our archives at thelistenpodcast.com. There are 8 full seasons waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. This episode was produced by Lauren Lovett and edited by Lucas Munoz Jetmore. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is Listen.